The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, off and running on another week of broadcasting here on KPCG. We got back from Efesh late last evening, and then we're able to log on live to the dance recital at Armstrong Auditorium, 3 in the afternoon in Oklahoma, 9 p.m. here in the UK. It was wonderful to see a lot of the step dancers, and also quite a few young people who are now doing some ballet, so some variety and some fun for everyone. On today's show, we're going to be speaking of Armstrong Auditorium. Yesterday, our very own Brad McDonald and Shane Granger, who works in the marketing department in Edmond, they were both on the local CBS affiliate in Oklahoma City yesterday, talking about the upcoming exhibit that kicks off next Sunday. We're now less than a week away, so coming up later on today's show, we'll be playing that little two-minute clip or that two-minute interview between Mr. Granger, Mr. McDonald, and the CBS reporter there in Oklahoma City. That, and also I'd like to get into a Bible study on the subject of the search for the truth. You see in the world today so many lies, and as we'll play for you later, Herbert Armstrong talked about how prone we are to accept falsehoods, to just go right along with the crowd when, you know, if the crowd is wrong, that's a dangerous, dangerous course to be on. So we'll talk more about that search for the truth and that biblical foundation that we all need. I've touched on this to some degree in recent weeks. Well, on this day in 1940, Great Britain completed its evacuation of Dunkirk. I think most of the major operations finished up on June the 3rd, and then it was final. It was complete on June 4th, this day back in 1940. That unbelievable period of history for Britain, when they used this flotilla of fishing boats and yachts, lifeboats. There were a few Navy vessels as well, merchant marines and such. But here comes this flotilla over the course of 3 or 4 days, rescuing more than 300,000 Brits, mostly British soldiers, who were trapped in Dunkirk leading up to that time of trial. King George VI called for a national day of prayer for God to perform a miracle, a mighty miracle, as so many of these soldiers, tens of thousands of soldiers, were facing an impossible predicament, surrounded and trapped between the channel and of course German troops. These allies had retreated to Dunkirk, and they were trapped there. They were basically preparing to be slaughtered. But God intervened. Hitler, for one, commanded his panzer tank divisions to hold off so that the Luftwaffe could have the honor of attacking these withdrawing Brits. But the weather took a change for the worse from the German perspective, as the violent rain and wind grounded the German Air Force. And meanwhile, the waters were unbelievably calm crossing the channel. And so here come all of these small boats to rescue these stranded soldiers. In Winston Churchill's words, 335,000 British troops were delivered out of the jaws of death and shame. And he also mentioned that this is not a victory for us. You don't get a victory in war by retreating. But this was, nevertheless, a tremendous miracle that saved the British Army. There was a Plain Truth article from 1985 And this author says, I've spent 4 years of my adult life in Britain and talked to several older men who were personally familiar with the Dunkirk rescue operation. They all got a certain glint or tear in their eyes when they talked about it. They all remembered the outpouring of gratitude to God by the British people after this event. For Sunday, June 9th, 1940, was appointed as a day of national thanksgiving for God's deliverance at Dunkirk. And many English vicars will tell you that their churches were packed on that day and have never been full since. A lot has changed. A lot has changed since June 4th, or in this case, that Sunday of observance on June 9th, 1940. It says here in this article, the day before, this is June 8th, 1940, Britain's Daily Telegraph ran an article about what it called the miraculous deliverance of Dunkirk. Imagine the Telegraph today writing about the miraculous deliverance of these soldiers. The article quotes a British officer, it says, who had been brought safely back across the channel from Dunkirk. This officer is quoted as saying, "One thing can be certain about tomorrow's Thanksgiving in our churches. For none will the thanks ascend with greater sincerity or deeper fervor than from the officers and men who have seen the hand of God powerful to save," it says, "delivering them from the hands of a mighty foe who, humanly speaking, had them utterly at his mercy. God intervened. And the officers who witnessed it, the people who were involved with it, all the parishioners, the priests, the ministers, the clergy, the journalists even, the newspapers, they were acknowledging the hand of God, the miraculous hand of God. It was a different time. It was a different time for sure. There was a study, another one of those YouGov.UK surveys, and it pointed out how that young people today are less proud of their nationality. They're less proud to be British. No surprise here. I mean, we've been completely ripped apart from our foundation, any kind of spiritual foundation. Young people, it says, are far less likely to feel proud to be English than older generations. A major survey for the BBC reveals 8 out of 10 people in England identify strongly as English, but pride varies by age. They took this study, conducted, I think, with something like 20,000 people, and they found that 72% of those over 65, they're proud to be English. And that compares with only 45% between the ages of 18 to 24. They're not so proud to be English. A minority of young people are actually proud to be English. And then, of course, so many of the older ones that say there's still pride there, they also acknowledge that England was better in the past. I mean, who can deny that? The empire is now gone. I mean, this is a secular nation in so many ways. It shows what happens when, like it says in Romans 1, when you don't acknowledge God, when you don't thank God, when you don't keep God in your knowledge, when you don't glorify Him, well, you can go on professing yourself to be wise all that you want. But God says there in that passage that He just gives you over to reprobate thinking, minds void of judgment, and then all of the vile affections that come along with it. We'll touch on that a little bit more when we get through the rest of the news here. You might recall a while back when Prime Minister Netanyahu from Israel, he had that dramatic revealing of all those secret files that Israeli spies had removed from a warehouse in Tehran And he's been hard at work since the U.S. pulled out of the Iran nuclear agreement. He's been hard at work trying to get the rest of the players, in Europe in particular, to tear up the nuclear deal. It says here in the Times of Israel, the Times of UK, sorry, Israel raised the pressure on Britain and its European partners last night to tear up the nuclear deal with Iran by sharing secret files showing Tehran's determination to build a bomb. And basically the documents that that Israel has been pointing the Europeans to, it shows how the military in Iran was responsible for the weapons-grade enriched uranium project. In other words, showing that this is not meant for civilian purposes, something that I think everyone in the world understood or believed, but still to have it documented. Look, these are the players in this deal. We can't trust them. And so he's pleading his case and of course feeling stronger in doing so because of the United States backing. It's a very different administration in the White House now than it was a year and a half ago. I've been reading through Michael Oren's book Allies. It's a book he wrote in 2015. He was the ambassador to the United States from Israel, I think between 2009 and 2013, so basically the first 4 or 5 years of the Obama administration. It's a real eye-opener. I didn't read the book at the time when it came out, but it's a real eye-opener, just the hostility that Israel faced right as soon as Obama set foot in the White House. They made it clear from the beginning, you're going to freeze all construction in any controversial zone. You've got to stop with it, which no previous U.S. president had done. No U.S. president had taken a position that extreme. Well, now there's a new direction, as my father has said, in the White House, and Israel is taking advantage of it. Coming back to Europe here, there was a story yesterday, I won't go through much of it, but it was in Politico about Angela Merkel endorsing Emmanuel Macron's EU military plan. This is, again, something that we've kept our eye on for years and years and years, and it will happen for those that are skeptics. There will be this European army, this joint military force. Emmanuel Macron is pushing for it, and Germany's been dragging its feet, but yesterday, or Sunday, Merkel said she supports this idea of a joint European defense force. This is from Politico, as I say. Merkel's French counterpart, Macron, has been pushing for the creation of a combined EU military force that could be deployed to trouble spots around the world. The idea had so far received a frosty reception in Berlin. But then it says further on, Merkel's intervention represents a significant change in tone. So there's a significant change in the tone, and imagine what happens when there's a significant change in the leadership in Germany. That's coming, and soon. There's more and more crises that the Europeans are having to confront. It's not just the rise of strongmen all over the world. It's that, well, it's happening in Europe as well, in these individual states. And it's posing a threat. Richard Palmer has been talking about the crises in Italy and Spain recently on the Trumpet Hour. You can go back and listen to Friday's program for more on that, just to follow on a little bit with what he's talked about, though. It says here at the German publication Der Spiegel, Eurosceptic Italian populists are posing a serious threat to the European Union. Following the drama over Greece and Brexit, the political situation in Rome could throw Europe into its next major existential crisis. Then talks about this Matteo Salvini, the 45-year-old leader of the right-wing nationalist party in Italy, and how that he's been promising for years that he would lead Italy out of the Eurozone if he ever got the chance. It says further on in the piece, Salvini, a fan of Vladimir Putin, a foe of the Euro, an anti-migrant politician, and a defender of Mussolini, and a man who also likes to lash out at Germany from time to time. This is how he's described. And this follows, you know, Orban and Kurz, some of the others in Eastern Europe. I mentioned last week this cover on Time magazine that's very similar to the one that we had several months previous to that. The rise of the strongman. This is what Europe needs. This is what many in Europe want. One of our listeners sent me this piece from Ed Conway on Friday in the Times of London. It says, the Eurozone needs a Trump to shake it up. That's the title of his article. What the single currency needs is not to tear itself apart, but to be disrupted. It needs an anti-establishment politician to throw out the Brussels rulebook and to replace it with a growth-focused version, it says. It needs someone who will rewrite the currency's fiscal and monetary rules and introduce continent-wide powers to tax, spend, and borrow. It needs, for want of a better phrase, to drain the swamp. It's catching on around the world. It says, so who will be Europe's Trump? Emmanuel Macron has some neat reform ideas, but has failed to generate much enthusiasm in Berlin. More likely, it will be someone we haven't heard of yet. Isn't that interesting? Here's Ed Conway weighing in on this future strongman. We need a Trump. We need a European version of Trump, and it's likely that we haven't even heard of him yet. It says, but Europe needs to find its disruptor-in-chief soon. Even as Italy struggles to create a government, there is an increasing chance of Spain losing one and calling fresh elections. These are only the latest reminders that the Euro crisis has not gone away. And so what does it need to solve these problems? It needs a Trump, a leader like President Trump, who can come in and drain the swamp. Of course, we know, and Richard brought this out on Trumpet Hour Friday, we know from Revelation 17 quite a few details about how this union will look before it's all said and done, these 10 kings that come together. Well, that's, of course, discussed in quite a lot of our literature, the booklets and such that we have on the book of Revelation in particular. When we come back, I'll follow up on what we ended last week with. We had a couple of programs there at the end of the week about the presidential administration that really did pose a serious threat to journalism and to free speech. And we'll tie up some loose ends on that in the next segment. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments, as always, to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. Is there a more urgent expression in the Bible than the last hour? When he wrote his epistles, the Apostle John thought it was the last hour before Christ's second coming. In fact, it was only a type of our time today. Every detail of what John prophesied is now being fulfilled. Request the last hour. Never before has proper time management been more important, and this book will give you the urgency you need to organize your life God's way. Request The Last Hour. As part of this free offer, request The 7 Laws of Success by Herbert W. Armstrong, one of his most popular books ever. If you want to be a successful life organizer, then you need to read The 7 Laws of Success by Herbert W. Armstrong. Again, both books are completely free. So contact us now and get the help you need to organize your life God's way. The Trumpet Daily.
And we are back, hopefully. We had a few technical difficulties, but I think that they happened during the break. So if you're listening live, let's just hope that you haven't missed anything. We had about a 6 or 7 minute layoff there. In any event, I mentioned there at the end of the first segment the two programs that we had last week where we talked about the Obama administration targeting journalists and leakers, prosecuting them, and really abusing its power, as James Risen brought out in several interviews and in an article that he wrote there at the end of 2016. And yet, despite all of this, the media absolutely adored Barack Obama, and they still do. And it gets back to what my father wrote about in America Under Attack, the swooning. The swooning of these people, these journalists, in the presence of Barack Obama. Michael Hastings talked about this in his interview with Martin Bashir back in 2013. Here's clip one.
That's the presence of Obama, even on the press corps, even on the people who follow him every day. When they're near him, they lose their mind sometimes. You know, they start behaving in ways that are juvenile and amateurish, and they swoon.
And of course, you don't.
Oh, I do. No, I did. Oh, I totally. Oh man, I first met President Obama in 2006 when he was a senator. He was visiting Baghdad. I was the correspondent there.
You mentioned that.
I mentioned that. And of course, I got to ask my question. So of course, I have to say, well, you know, Mr. President, this is the second time I met you. And did I ask the hardball question? Did I ask about drones? Did I ask about civil liberties? No, I did not. I guess I'm not at liberty to say what I asked about, but it was soft.
Typical. Thank you for the admission.
That's Martin Bashir saying typical. They all knew they did that. They all knew they swooned. But as he said there, they just lose their minds. They'd lose their minds. And President Obama could prosecute them. He could send them to prison. And they still would rave about him, how much they loved him. Ben Rhodes has a new book coming out, The World as It Is. It got some publicity over the weekend. I guess they're producing excerpts of it at the New York Times. And it's interesting. Here's another glowing report. Maureen Dowd, by the way, she wrote about some of the excerpts from Ben Rhodes' book, and even where there was a section that kind of made Obama out to look like he had some self-doubt or whatever, she kind of twists this around and says, no, really, what was going on there was he was just too good for us. He was, you know, he was ahead of his time. It's really an unbelievable column from Maureen Dowd. She says, as president, Obama always found us wanting. We were constantly disappointing him. It's like he's the parent and all the rest of us are the children. He would tell us the right thing to do and then sigh and purse his lips when his instructions were not followed. She quotes from Rhodes' book and says, this is Obama apparently asking his aides, what if we're wrong? What if we were wrong? But in his next breath, the president made it clear what he meant. What if we were wrong in being so right? What if we were too good for these people? That's how Maureen Dowd takes this passage in Ben Rhodes' book. I mean, what if we were so right? What if we were just so too good for these people? What if we were too good for them? Maybe we pushed too far, the president's quoted as saying. Maybe people just want to fall back into their tribe. So really, here's Maureen Dowd, her take. He's not acknowledging any flaws, but simply wondering if we were even more benighted than he thought. He's saying that, sadly, we were not enlightened enough for the momentous changes wrought by the smartest people in the world, or even evolved enough for the first African-American president. See, in their minds, he's God. He still is. He still is. He had no flaws. It doesn't matter what he did, who he prosecuted. It doesn't matter the restraints that he put on freedom of the press. It says here, sometimes I wonder whether I was 10 or 20 years too early, Obama mused to his aides. And then Maureen Dowd says, we just weren't ready for his amazing awesomeness. That's crazy. You can't really get any swoonier than that. And the mistakes, I mean, the only mistake he made was that he put his support behind a really bad candidate, Hillary Clinton. It should have been Joe Biden or someone else who was another Obama, but not this woman. He shouldn't have risked his reputation. He shouldn't have preemptively exonerated Hillary Clinton. That's what she says now. If only we would have had a better candidate. Dowd says, I couldn't shake the feeling that I should have seen it coming. This is actually quoting Rhodes himself. Rhodes writes about the darkness that enveloped him when he saw the electoral map turn red. We saw this movie last week about this documentary, The Final Year, or The Last Year, I think it's called. But there's this scene in there. They were operating, remember, they were operating in a world where Hillary Clinton would win. They just assumed it would happen. And then that's what influenced and informed basically every decision or strategy they had all through 2016. They just knew she'd win. They couldn't believe that Donald Trump would win. And in fact, they were doing everything that they could, legal and illegal, to prevent it. But Rhodes is saying now, looking back, in hindsight, I mean, I guess I should have seen it coming. He says, because when you distilled it, stripped out of racism and misogyny, we'd run against Hillary 8 years ago with the same message Trump had used. She's part of a corrupt establishment that can't be trusted to change. That's the approach they took in 2008, the Obama people, that is. She's corrupt. She's the establishment. You need someone new and fresh. So I should have seen it coming, Rhodes says. But here's the conclusion to Maureen Dowd's piece. She says, even though he could make magic, like the time he sang Amazing Grace at a funeral for black parishioners murdered by a white supremacist in South Carolina, Obama did not like persuading people to do what they didn't want to do. And that is the definition of politics. He wanted them simply to do what he had ascertained to be right. And here she is, writing at the New York Times, lamenting the fact that we were just too stupid to understand his amazing awesomeness, to use her words. Well, Ben Rhodes, he's got his book now, and now he's been hired on at MSNBC. He's there with Josh Earnest, I believe, the former press spokesman. All these Obama people. They're getting, and in Ben Rhodes' case in particular, you know what happened back in 2014 and 15, and then the big New Yorker article that came out in 2016 after the Iran nuclear deal was finalized. And here's Ben Rhodes bragging about how they manipulated the press, telling the world how stupid the major media were and how easy it was to create this false narrative. How easy it was for him to create this echo chamber to manipulate the media. And in the case of Obama himself, as I said last week, Here he was actually targeting journalists, and yet they still love him. They still swoon, and they want Ben Rhodes, of all people, to work for their news organizations, MSNBC, NBC. He's a top analyst now. He used to make fun of the press. He used to tell us how stupid they were. But now they really want him. And you look at these figures, I've mentioned the intel community. John Brennan working for, who is it, either CNN or MSNBC. You have Clapper at CNN. Then you have Ben Rhodes now, Josh Earnest, all of them. I mean, and this just highlights that that administration is not going away. No matter what they say or don't say, in the case of, you know, President Obama being involved in any of these scandals, they're still going to erase that history. But he's out there, the Canadian premier, Justin Trudeau. He was on, I think, Meet the Press just yesterday, the Canadian prime minister. And he opened up about the advice that Obama was giving him in the last weeks of his presidency. President Obama basically telling the Canadian prime minister, you've got to speak up more. Your voice is going to need to stand up to the Trump administration. He said in that interview yesterday, you're going to have to speak out when certain values are threatened. You see, they're cut from the same cloth, Trudeau and Obama. You're going to have to speak out when our values are threatened. His influence is still there. It's all throughout the media, as I say. It's all throughout the deep state. Certainly at the top tier of those intelligence organizations, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA. It's deep. That influence runs deep. All of that radical leftist transformation that Obama was bent on carrying out. And then everything that he put in place right there at the end to attack his successor. I mentioned last week we're putting together this 40-day timeline going back from early December 2016 to the end of January when President Trump was inaugurated as president, the 45th president of the United States. And there's a lot of interesting stories, a lot that was going on. Barack Obama was quite busy in those final days. Now, you look at Ben Rhodes' account. Here he comes out with his book a year and a half after the fact, and he's talking about just how stunned they were and President Obama's reaction and the anger that was there when Donald Trump won the election. And then, like this video brought out, I mean, Ben Rhodes had to go outside just to gather his thoughts. And the video, the documentarian follows him out and says, you know, hey, what do you think? And he couldn't speak. He was literally speechless. I don't know what to say. He practically looked like he was in tears. They thought this was outrageous. They thought, and they still think, that Donald Trump is a big joke. He's just a buffoon. You can't take him seriously. He's just, it's one scandal after another after another. Well, you go back to that 40-day period, this January 12th, 2017. This would have been one week before Donald Trump was inaugurated as president. I went through this some of this article last year, back when President Trump tweeted out that, hey, they've wiretapped Trump Tower. They did it during the transition. And he was mocked for that all throughout the media. And we've since learned that he was right. But if you go back to this article from January 2017, it says, in its final days, the Obama administration, in its final days, the Obama administration has expanded the power of the National Security Agency, that's NSA, to share globally intercepted personal communications with the government's 16 other intelligence agencies before applying privacy protections. It says the new rules significantly relax long-standing limits on what the NSA may do with the information gathered by its most powerful surveillance operations, which are largely unregulated by American wiretapping laws. Listen to that. All of this power that the NSA has to spy, now that information is going to be more widely available across 16 other intel agencies. The FBI, the CIA, all of them. Says these include collecting satellite transmissions, phone calls, and emails that cross network switches abroad, and messages between people abroad that cross domestic network switches. And then you look at these scandals with the spying on President Trump and his administration, his campaign, and the involvement abroad, British authorities and spies, Australia, and others too. All of this information being picked up, used in its investigation, quote unquote. It says the change means that far more officials will be searching through raw data. And all of this happens conveniently enough, days, just a few days before President Trump is inaugurated. This article talks about how that James Clapper signed the document that approved of this. That was on December 15th, 2016. Loretta Lynch, she signed on January the 3rd. It says, previously, the NSA filtered information before sharing intercepted communications with other agencies, like the CIA or the intelligence branches of the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administrations. The NSA analysts passed on only information they deemed pertinent, screening out the identities of innocent people and irrelevant personal information. Now, it says, now, other intelligence agencies will be able to search directly through raw repositories of communications intercepted by the NSA and then apply such rules for minimizing privacy intrusions. So now, in hindsight, yeah, you look at everything since, all the unmasking, all of the wiretapping, Paul Manafort, Carter Page, listening in. Here in the final days, you have the FBI and the CIA. I mean, they have the powerful, powerful tools of surveillance right on par with the NSA. Now, even if you leave aside the elephant in the room, the fact that all of this is happening, right as they're conducting this counterintelligence operation against the Trump campaign, they say Russia today, but let's be straight. And then, of course, the special counsel that started a few months after this. Leave all of that aside. Just think about President Obama and the world in which they were operating. Obama, Ben Rhodes, James Comey, Brennan, and all of them. Clapper. They were operating in a world where Hillary Clinton would win. Furthermore, they viewed Donald Trump as a buffoon, as a danger, a dangerous lunatic, a misogynist, a racist. If that's the way that they viewed him, and they still do, they make no bones about it. But why in the world would the Obama administration, days before this madman, this tyrant, this supposed buffoon, why would the Obama administration, just days before he takes office, all of a sudden expand these powers of the agencies that fall underneath the authority of the executive branch, the president? Why would Barack Obama carry this out through James Clapper and Loretta Lynch and the others, unless he knew that those agencies would work together in bringing down his successor, in bringing down the next administration? Why would he do this unless he knew that he had his people, so many of them in place, in those top positions, at those agencies and that they would use these expanded powers just days before the new president is sworn into office. He knew he had the people in place. He knew he had the agencies working to carry out his will. It really is will worship, like I said last week. There is nothing that he does that is wrong in the eyes of these kinds of anti-American forces, including so many people in the media. You see the influence even to this day, as I say, it's all over the place. That's because the Obama people, they're still there, so many of them. And they're just carrying out Plan B. I mean, Plan A was Hillary Clinton. It was supposed to be her who's in the Oval Office right now. And when that didn't work out, you look at all that they were doing during that 40-day period. There's a lot of evil still there. I mean, God has obviously intervened, as I said last week. He's saved Israel from the radical left. He's saved the United States. Out of his mercy, out of his love, to give us one last opportunity. But you see, I mean, you still see just what this current administration is going up against. I talked on Friday about this pardon of Dinesh D'Souza. And this is from The Hill last week, toward the end of the week. D'Souza, I think, was pardoned on Wednesday or Thursday last week. But it says here, New York Interim Attorney General Barbara Underwood said on Thursday that President Trump's pardoning of conservative commentator Dinesh D'Souza shows his willingness to thwart justice and adds urgency to the state's double jeopardy loophole. What is she getting at? This powerful official in New York. It says President Trump's latest pardon makes crystal clear his willingness to use his pardon power to thwart the cause of justice rather than advance it. That's what the New York Attorney General said. By pardoning D'Souza, President Trump is undermining the rule of law by pardoning a political supporter who is an unapologetic convicted felon. She says, finally, lawmakers must act now to close New York's double jeopardy loophole and ensure that anyone who evades federal justice by virtue of a politically expedient pardon can be held accountable if they violate New York law. So now they're looking for ways to get around the federal pardon. And that, well, if he's pardoned by the president, we've got to try to get around this loophole to be able to prosecute him in according to New York law. As D'Souza brought out over the weekend on Fox, I mean, basically this just confirms everything that he's said since the beginning of this ordeal to now. That while what he did was wrong, this is without question a politically motivated trial and conviction. This is what he said on Fox over the weekend, clip two.
Far from shuddering at this latest development, I'm actually chuckling about it because I think it's very eye-opening. I have maintained from the beginning that this prosecution in my case was political, that it was motivated by the Obama administration's desire to somehow get me. And the other side, the progressives, Preet Bharara, my prosecutor, said, no, that's not the case. This is just civil servants acting, carrying out the law in the normal course of things. Mm-hmm. And so here comes the attorney general. This is the highest judicial official in the state of New York. Yeah. And she's basically saying, listen, the normal course of things didn't work. This guy got away. And now we got to get him some other way. So let's come up with a strategy for prosecuting people twice.
Right.
My favorite term is the double jeopardy loophole. So this basic constitutional protection, Ed, has now become a loophole. And I guess if I had gotten off because of an illegal search and seizure, they'd want to close the illegal search and seizure loophole, mm-hmm. or the Fifth Amendment loophole. So you see that these people will stop at nothing. It confirms that this is a political hit, and if they don't get their way, they want to be able to take a second strike.
That's Dinesh D'Souza speaking over the weekend, following his pardon last week. President Trump pardoned him. And as he says, the people, these people will stop at nothing. They are not going to stop. They're not going to take this lying down. They're writing their books. They're being hired by major media corporations. And they're carrying on with this fight. Anything and everything that they can do to complete the radical transformation. God, though, very mercifully intervened for you and for me to help us see this great evil and to help us understand and know that the solution to this is not in any political campaign or party. Far from it. The solution is God. But look at the evil, so pervasive. And then the double standard, too. As one comedian said over the weekend, I mean, if you say it and it's aimed at anyone on the right, particularly Donald Trump, you can say literally whatever you want to say about him. It could be the most vile, disgusting commentary you could imagine. But not when it's coming from the other direction. I think the guy said that you can't even say a knock-knock joke about Obama without having the FBI all over you. And then added to all of this, I mean, you have to have your eyes completely shut to not see that there are some positive things happening for the United States because of God's mercy. Particularly with the economy, the North Korean summit that's now back on. The president's enemies. They mocked him last year when the rhetoric was so fiery, saying that he was going to cause World War III. He was going to trigger it. Donald Trump. He's more dangerous than the North Korean dictator. That's what they were saying a year ago. And then he's about to have this summit, and they don't know quite what to say. And then the summit falls through, and they all laugh, and they all think, what an idiot. What a fool. And now the summit's back on. And now what are they saying? Who knows? You look at the economy. There was a piece on Friday in the New York Times. The jobs report comes out. There's more positive numbers. Unemployment's going down. Even the New York Times acknowledged that the economy is in a sweet spot with steady growth and broad improvement in the labor market. This article, by the way, I mean, the Times pulls out the thesaurus, even says so in the introduction, to point out or to bring out all the positive words that it can find. I didn't quite know if I should take it serious or not. It seemed like it was written as if, okay, he's going to criticize us for not reporting the good news. So here's the good story, and we're going to throw in all of these positive words just so that we can say we've covered it. The booming economy. CNBC wrote over the weekend that the U.S. economy suddenly looks like it's unstoppable. It's not going to last. We're not saying that it's going to last. But these are, nevertheless, positive reports that the major media really, really are struggling to talk about. Here's what CNN's Brian Stelter had to say yesterday on his news program, Clip 4.
For pro-Trump media outlets, there's a lot of great news to celebrate and a lot of news for the mainstream media to be reporting as well. But stories like those exist in the calm eye of a hurricane. You've heard about this before, right? The eye of a hurricane. When you're in the eye, the wind stops, the rain stops, you can hear birds chirping. Sometimes you can even see a glimmer of sunlight. You can almost convince yourself that the storm is over. You can almost convince yourself the storm has passed. To me, that's how some of these days feel. You know, when I'm seeing stories about the economy and how well it's chugging along, when I hear Trump cheerleaders talking about how he's making America great again and how all this Russia stuff is a deep state hoax, I start to think that we're in the clear. But then there comes a story about Trump's abuse of power, or a story about scandalous conflicts of interest, or a story about his legal troubles, and suddenly the storm is raging again.
And that's what they're there to report, just the storm. Forget about the eye of the storm. It's not really that real. It's not really happening. I mean, we're about to be devastated by the Trump hurricane. The storm is raging. They don't want the truth. They won't report the truth. They want to take down the president. This book, Michael Oren's book, by the way, he had this example in there from 2009. You might remember this was early on in the Obama presidency when Israel had been at war with Hamas in Gaza, and then this Goldstone report comes out following that war that basically just condemns Israel and saying that Israel killed and Hamas was they were let off scot free, and people in Israel were furious. The UN and those kinds of organizations were running with this report because, well, it was produced by a Jewish judge, so it must be right. It must be objective. Well, Goldstone, a year later, came out and renounced his own report, and as Michael Oren brings out in his book, he tried to get his op-ed piece printed in the New York Times that was so happy to just savagely report on Israel and the IDF. He tried to get the correction printed in the New York Times following that report a year later, and the New York Times didn't want it. It's like Michael Oren says, they'd rather go with the old story that was false, that was fabricated, because that fits in better with their agenda. That's what you see happening so much, I mean, in our society today. I mean, again, going back to Romans 1, one of our listeners as well pointed out this passage in Romans 1 about all of the evil. Genesis 6, same thing. So much evil, and yet God's giving us a temporary, a short-term opportunity to turn to Him during this period of a temporary saving. Well, that's all that we have time for today. Sorry for the technical problems we had earlier in the show, and we'll have to push our Bible study back to tomorrow's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.